Everybody, please join me in clapping and welcoming Molly to the stage.
So I'm going to kick stuff off by talking about what schizophrenia is. Because traditionally, like, the media and stuff doesn't do very well with, like, mental health, and people don't know all the facts about mental illness. So I thought I'd go through what schizophrenia is to start off with. So it's a chronic, severe, and disabling brain disorder that has affected people throughout history. So back in, like, Egyptian times, there are reports of disorders that kind of sound like schizophrenia. So it's not a new thing. And the symptoms that present in schizophrenia can be classified as positive, negative, and cognitive. So the positive symptoms are those ones that are not present in healthy individuals, but are present in an individual with schizophrenia. So that's things like hallucinations and delusions. And they're the ones that kind of get talked about a lot, I guess. But there are also negative symptoms, and those are the symptoms that are things that are present in healthy individuals, but not necessarily present in individuals with schizophrenia. So these are things like lack of interest in social activities, really blunt emotional profiles, lack of motivation, things like that. And there are also cognitive symptoms like difficulty focusing and paying attention and things like that. And what I personally find really interesting about symptoms in schizophrenia is you can look at two people who have a diagnosis of schizophrenia and there can be absolutely no overlap in their symptom profile whatsoever. Because there's no one symptom that's like, that symptom means that person has schizophrenia. And similar to that, you can look at someone 5 years down the line and their symptom profile can have changed completely. So they cannot be experiencing any of the symptoms that they had initially. Schizophrenia also exists across all cultures and all socioeconomic groups. It's more common in some socioeconomic groups, like it's more common in lower socioeconomic groups, but it exists across the population. And it also affects about 1% of the population, so it's not that rare, and it's highly likely that people will, you know, have experiences themselves or with their friends and family that have had schizophrenia. And the symptoms tend to develop around ages 16 to 25, younger in guys than in women. As well as talking about what schizophrenia is, I think it's really important to talk about what schizophrenia is not. And it is not multiple personality disorder. And this gets, like, confused in the media a lot. And you see a lot of these, like cartoons like this, like, thanks for curing my schizophrenia, we're both fine now. And it's nothing to do with, like, a split in personality. And also, patients with schizophrenia aren't violent or dangerous at all. And that kind of has got, like, mixed up in the media as well. So, like, the word psychotic, which is used to describe those positive symptoms, that seems to have changed in meaning, because what that actually means is a loss of contact with reality. But it comes off as a bit more, like, darker and more violent nowadays, I think. It kind of gets a bad kind of, like, explanation in the media, I think. And also, schizophrenia is not unmanageable. There isn't a cure for schizophrenia, but schizophrenia can be treated and medicated, and people can manage their symptoms. So, as I said, schizophrenia has, like, a really long history, but schizophrenia as we know it now goes back, like, maybe just less than 100 years. And these two dudes are kind of what kicked it off, as we know it now. So, this guy, Emil Kraepelin, he presented the concept dementia praecox, which he said was a brain disorder, and it started from damage to the cerebral cortex. Now, dementia is a really old term, and that means like cognitive and behavioral deterioration, and the praecox meant premature. So he was trying to make the distinction between, you know, like old, dementia in old ages. This was a cognitive deterioration that was occurring in younger people. And then this other guy, Eugene Bleuler, proposed the term schizophrenia, which he took from the Greek schizo, which means split, and phrein, which means mind. And what that's supposed to mean was not split personality, but a split from reality, as evidenced by these hallucinations and delusions that sufferers kind of showed. And why are we, like, really interested in, like, researching schizophrenia? It's because it has a really high cost. It has a really high burden on the families and friends of sufferers. It's a large financial burden on the healthcare system. But also, individuals with schizophrenia are at increased risk of committing suicide. So there's like a 10%, I think individuals with schizophrenia, about 10% of them will commit suicide, which is like super high. And also current treatments that we have are good at alleviating certain kinds of symptoms, but not others. So those positive symptoms that I talked about, like the hallucinations and the delusions, antipsychotic medications treat them fairly well. But the negative symptoms, like the low mood and the lack of motivation, they can be really treatment resistant. So if we can understand the causes and the mechanisms of schizophrenia, then hopefully we can treat it better, right? So there's... If you try and do like a literature review on the risk factors for schizophrenia, you get all sorts of stuff. So individuals that are born in winter are at a greater risk for schizophrenia. There's a lot of literature about like teenage drug use. And it's thought that there's like a cumulative effect of all these risk factors, right? So it's not just due to winter births. It's not just due to parental age. But there's like a cumulative effect. So when you do a literature review, pretty much everything is implicated in the causes of schizophrenia. And this is from a comic book called Psychiatric Tales, 11 Graphic Stories About Mental Illness by Daryl Cunningham. And if anything can be explained to me through comic books, that's the best way of doing it. So it's super cool. But by far the most powerful risk factor for schizophrenia is having a family member who is affected. So as you can see, as the number of genes that you share with a family member increases, so does your risk of developing schizophrenia. So there's about a 1% prevalence of schizophrenia in the general population. But if you have an identical twin who you share 100% of your DNA with, your risk of developing schizophrenia is about 48%. So that's really high. But the genetic studies of schizophrenia have been really frustrating. And there's been a lot of them that have been trying to look at and find the genes linked with schizophrenia. And there'll be a big study, and they'll find a gene that's related to schizophrenia, and then 2 years later, another study will come along and fail to replicate that. And it's happened a lot, and the genetics of schizophrenia are just so much more complicated than people thought. And the kind of the consensus now is that schizophrenia is a combination of relatively common risk genes that have a really small effect in increasing the risk, and then there are some rare genes with relatively large effects. So that's about the risk factors and genetic risk. But what about the mechanism? What's going on in the brain? So prior to the advent of neuroimaging, all you could really do is look at dead brains. And that's not a dead brain. That's just a cake I made. but you could look at dead brains. And for years and years and years, the researchers had said that schizophrenia was a brain disorder. But when you're looking at dead brains, there's only so much information you can get. You can only really see the structure of the brain because the brain's not working because it's a dead brain. And you can only really see really large abnormalities. You can't see like these subtle kind of subtle things. There were other methods. Like there's one, I think it's called I can't remember the name, but it involved like a lumbar puncture, draining all the fluid from around your brain, replacing with air, and then X-raying the brain. And that wasn't very helpful because it was very painful and you got a really grainy x-ray. So prior to neuroimaging, there wasn't really much going on. But then, neuroimaging, yay! And so advances in neuroimaging really provided researchers, and this was like the late 70s, early 80s, really provided researchers a whole new window into the human body. And they really revolutionized like every area of medicine, including psychiatry. Because what it did, it meant you could look like in exquisite detail at the structure of the brain, but you could also look at the brain functioning, and you could also look at the same person over several years, because these dead brains, you just get a person's dead brain on a table, and you can't look how it changes. With neuroimaging, because it's non-invasive, you can scan people every year for 5 years and see what's developing with the illness. And also, neuroimaging is super cool because it keeps me in a job. So there's a bunch of different types of imaging that you can do. So we get, where am I? So this kind of image up here, this is my brain. You can get high-res structural images of the brain. So you can look in real detail at the structure of the brain. You can also do, this is a DTI image, and this looks at white matter tracts in the brain. So this is looking at the pathways in the brain. This is a PET image, and it's looking at like the metabolic processes in the brain. And this is a functional magnetic resonance image. And So what these yellow blobs here are the responses of the brain when it's looking at faces. So you can look at different properties of the brain as well, which is something else you can't really do with dead brains. Now, initial imaging studies of the brain were kind of, they came from like a kind of modularity of mind approach a lot of the time. So people were very concerned in like, which bit of the brain does this? Like you can see, you know, like the old phrenology heads, that people are like, this part of the brain is responsible for X. Like this part of the brain is responsible for coffee. And this one is the ego. I think we have Y2K here as well. And that works for some things. That does work for some things. So like vision, you can map in the occipital cortex really well things like motion. So these like kind of retinotopic maps, you get these like checkerboards that are kind of like donuts and they're expanding. And based on where it is on the in the visual field, different areas of the brain are active. So that works really well. And then you also get these, this is like the motor cortex. I don't know how well the text underneath came out. This is the motor cortex, and there's kind of a homunculus there. So in the motor cortex, it's very cleanly mapped which part of the body that part of the cortex is responsible for. And it's the same idea for the somatosensory cortex, although the areas of the body are mapped slightly differently. So it does work really well for some things, but for something like complex like schizophrenia, it doesn't really work very well at all. And a lot of the, so they did, and also, so like schizophrenia imaging research is fairly recent. So like the first MRI study in schizophrenia, I think it was like 1984. So it's only been going on for like 33 years. The first DTI study was something like 98. So that's like less than a 20-year history. So there's not that much research going on. But a lot of people have, you know, done these imaging studies in schizophrenia. And and when they've looked at these like focal abnormalities, you know, like try to pinpoint schizophrenia to a part of the brain, these are the areas that they've identified. There are a fuck ton. And like these are like, so there's like, there's some of them are like gray matter volume abnormalities, some of them are structural abnormalities, some of them are functional abnormalities. But it's not very helpful to say, oh, what, you know, what part of the brain is affected in schizophrenia? These parts of the brain, because it's a lot of the brain. So there are better ways of thinking about how schizophrenia affects the brain. And if we think about the brain, rather than as individual regions, if we think about brain circuits and networks, so if you think about the brain as being kind of split up into different networks that might be responsible for different tasks, and you can then think how those, how, you know, what brain regions make up those networks. Are they the same as schizophrenia and the same in healthy individuals? How do these networks interact? Do they switch between networks in the same way? And you can also, you can get a lot of information that is missed when you're just looking at these like focal studies of schizophrenia. So some of the cool research I think that's going on at the moment is looking in schizophrenia, is looking at how these networks behave. And what a lot of them do is they kind of like, they split the brain up into separate regions. And you can kind of have a way of, what you need is like a way of quantifying how these networks behave. So if you can think about a brain network or any network at all as being composed of like these nodes, which are the circles, and then you have these paths between them, you can then think about the brain more holistically, and you can think like how efficient is the brain at transmitting information? How efficient is it about transmitting information across long scales? And how efficient is it about sharing information locally? So like, do you have like little clusters of these of brain regions or nodes that are kind of nicely connected? And do you have like, and if you wanted to get from one region to another, how many paths do you need to go through? Because an efficient brain network would have nice ways of getting information across the brain without it having to go through each and every network. And actually, so this kind of like method of looking at the brain is called graph theory, and it has its roots in social media. And it's really, I've always found it really helpful to think about it through social media, because you can think about it how networks of people transmit information, right? So like, if I want to get this is like a load of Facebook profile pictures. But if I went to get a message, if you know, information needs to be transported from my friend Jen to my friend Dahlia, like how many networks would it need to go across? And do I have these like nice clusters of people that are like locally organized, say like people that I used to roller skate with and people that I work with? Do you have these clusters? So that's a nice way of like kind of quantifying how brains, how networks work. And you can do this with the brain. So you can look at the brain and split it up into all these different regions. And then you can assess whether the regions, you know, which regions are kind of talking to each other. And if you wanted to get a message from any of one brain region to another, how many paths would it have to go through? So this has been done in normal brains. And there's a very efficient setup in normal brains. They have this nice clustering, which means there is great local efficiency. But they also have path lengths, which means the information doesn't have to go through 14 different brain regions to make it across the brain. So in a healthy human brain, you have high global efficiency, and you also have high local efficiency. And that's what this looks like here. So this is a healthy control brain. And this is this isn't kind of like, don't think about this as the areas being actually anatomically located. This is just kind of how they fit together. So you can have these like nice clusters of information, and then like, but you also have nice clean paths across the brain. But then in schizophrenia, you don't have that global efficiency, and you don't have these nice clusters. So what that does is it gives you kind of a nice description of what's going wrong in the brain in schizophrenia globally, rather than thinking about an individual region or an individual area. And what that means for treatment is we can look at how drugs work and how drugs affect this hierarchical organization of the brain, rather than just kind of like giving individuals drugs and seeing what happens, which sometimes is what happens in schizophrenia. But there's still a lot more to do. As I say, schizophrenia brain imaging has only been going on for like the last sort of 20 years, and a lot of the early studies were very underpowered. You would have 8 individuals in a study and try and make assumptions on the brain through those 8 people, which is really tough to do. But it does, from the evidence that's coming out nowadays, it does seem that it's, rather than a focal abnormality, it's a really complex disorder of how the brain is interacting with other brain areas or interacting with other brain areas. So I'll finish it there. So my take-home messages, I guess, are like schizophrenia is like really complex, not just genetically, but also in terms of how the brain is working. And also, it's definitely not the same thing as multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, which gets banded around a lot, and it's not the same thing. So yeah, I think that's me.